Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
How I got into this predicament, I'll never know. Absolutely incredible. I, Boris Dmitrievich Grushenko, about to be executed for a crime I never committed. It seems like only yesterday that I was a child, surrounded by my loving family. Uncle Nikolai with his great laugh. My father, a simple man who owned a small piece of land. I remember having strange and vivid dreams. I grew to manhood and fell in love with Cousin Sonia. To me, she was the perfect woman.
I guess you could say I'm half saint, half whore.
Just hoping I get the half that eats.
Then came the war.
Napoleon has invaded Austria!
Fellas, I'm a pacifist. I don't believe in war.
Boris, you can't be serious. You're talking about Mother Russia.
She's not my mother. My mother's standing right here, and she's not going to let her youngest baby get shrapnel in his gum.
I recall the rigors of military training.
You're the worst soldier I ever seen!
The horrors of the battlefield. I remember my brief but torrid affair with the Countess Alexandrovna, the most exciting woman in all of St. Petersburg.
You're the greatest lover I've ever had.
I practice a lot when I'm alone.
Shall we say pistols at dawn?
Well, we can say it. I don't know what it means, but we can say it.
My duel to the death with the evil Ivan. And above all, my conquest of Sonia. Our marriage was the happiest time of my life, until she conceived the plan that was to be my downfall.
Let's assassinate Napoleon.
I tried to reason with her, but it was no use.
You find me attractive as a man?
Yes, I think that's your best bet.
The rest is history. Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, Love and Death.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is my intrepid co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
When something hurts herring, it hurts me.
Also along for the ride this week is guest co-host, writer, director, actor, man about town, Mr. Keith Gordon.
Hello. Glad to be here. And sorry, I can't come up with anything as witty to introduce myself.
We'll wait for the wit.
Okay. It'll show up sometime.
This week, we're talking about Woody Allen's Love and Death, the sixth feature film from Allen, that's counting What's Up, Tiger Lily, which was kind of once directed before. Love and Death is a wonderful hybrid of Russian literature, angst-ridden Swedish films, and the Marx Brothers. It's the story of Boris Grushenko, a nebbish Russian who constantly questions his existence, especially when the love of his life, his cousin Sonia, doesn't return his affections. Throw in a war, a Napoleon impersonator, adultery, and lots of death, and you're barely scratching the surface of Love and Death. Keith, as our guest, I'm going to ask you first, what's been your experience with Love and Death? When did you first see it, and what have you been your impressions of the film?
Well, I first saw the film before it was released. I was lucky enough that Charlie Jaffe, who was Woody Allen's longtime manager and executive producer, was actually my godfather, quite literally. His wife at that time and my mother had been best friends since high school, and my father knew Charlie somewhat from working in the business. And so I grew up around Charlie and his family. And so one of the wonderful perks of that was getting to go and see Woody's films when they were in like the preview stage. So I remember seeing this. I would have been, I guess, 14, because I think the film came out in 75, and I was born in 61. You know, I loved it, which any Woody fan would. But I think even at that point, I saw it as a big step forward. I mean, it was, you know, because I was a big film fan. And to me, it was so much more sophisticated than any of the films that Woody had done up to that point. I mean, everybody always talks about Annie Hall as sort of the great leap forward in Woody Allen's work, you know. But I think Love and Death was an incredibly important intermediate stop on the way there. It was much more visual and, you know, beautifully made, and it was a very cinematic film. I mean, before then, the films had, you know, they had been visual at times, but Love and Death was a beautifully made movie, which isn't something that Woody's carried through the rest of his career. A film I've gone back to a lot. I've seen it, you know, I don't know how many, like 10 times over the years. And as we were just talking about, you know, I'm really looking forward to it getting released on Blu-ray, which I can only assume will happen soon, because they're working their way through the back catalog, it seems like. But I loved it from the first time I saw it, and it only grows with time. I mean, the jokes don't grow stale, and in fact, they get better, from the political jokes about war to the Bergman references. It all kind of has aged very, very well, I think.
I think I saw it probably in high school, because I went through a huge phase of trying to watch every Woody Allen film I could get my hands on, probably on VHS at the time. And I really liked it, but I have to say it probably been 15 years since I've seen it. And I agree with Keith, just going back to it and having another look at it was great. And one of the things, and I don't think he knew this at the time, but if you look at the title, Love and Death, I think that really kind of represents Woody's two key muses of his work throughout his entire scope of his film directing and writing. It just it seems to be the two things he always wants to talk about, and I think here it's well done.
We talked a few weeks ago about Sleeper when we talked about Marshall Brickman's Simon, and that one, it was, you know, kind of a high concept, you know, what if Woody Allen were to be put in a coma for 200 years and come out, and, you know, it's kind of almost like, I mean, there was definitely a plot to it, but a lot of times it felt like kind of a series of skits. Whereas this one, it felt a little bit more cohesive, I guess. And also, I like that this is kind of, I'm trying to remember, I think in Take the Money and Run, we get to see a young Woody Allen. But in this one, we also get to see the young Boris Grishenko. And this one kind of, for me, Take the Money and Run was just so crazy. And this one kind of sets the stage as far as what we're going to see, like in some of his later films, where we get to see Woody interacting with young Woody. And I think you mentioned, Keith, just the look of the film was so much more sophisticated. I mean, some of the shots in this, I mean, the birch lined streets and just how gorgeous everything looked was just, it was really light years beyond Sleeper, which was only just, what, 2 years previous, I think.
The film is very beautiful, and it's sort of a combination of Eisenstein and references to Russian cinema in terms of some specific shots, but even more, it looks to me like a Bergman film. And obviously a lot of the film has got Bergman references in the writing and in the framing of shots and the faces. You know, there's definitely nods to Persona, and to me, there's a definite Sven Nykvist feel to the cinematography. But what was great about it was it's not merely a parody. It actually is capturing some of what's so beautiful about that cinematography as well. This film really was a coherent story. It wasn't, you know, up until now, the films had felt like brilliantly funny sketches, but a series of sketches tied together by an idea. This film really has a story, and I think that's what led to, with the next film, Annie Hall, taking that leap to being a great filmmaker and telling a very emotional as well as funny story. But this was the first time, I think, that Woody really told a story that wasn't just a great excuse for a bunch of sketches the way a Monty Python piece might be or something.
Yeah, we should probably talk a little bit more about the plot of the film. We start off with Woody Allen narrating as Boris Grishenko, kind of telling the whole story of him and his village and his family. I mean, family is very key to this. It's he and his mom and dad, and then he's got these two kind of, Neolithic brothers, and his cousin Sonia, who he loves, and just the way that he kind of dives in with, immediately, even as a little kid, he's asking questions about existence, and you've got all these great exchanges going on between all the characters, really, but especially when he and Sonia, they're constantly bantering about their place in the universe. And against that, well, there's two wars that happen in this film. We've got Boris going off to war. He's kind of shamed into it, and and goes off to fight. And then later on, we have another war that happens. And so everything kind of plays out against these. And we have kind of an episodic kind of way that we're presenting this stuff. But everything is building as we're going along with the plot.
And there's a lot of politics in the film, which I think has always been a part of Woody's humor. But I think you really feel it in this film. I mean, the comments on the absurdity of war are very strong. I mean, which I think helps the film also hold up really well. I mean, and that's, again, a hard thing to do because everyone knows war is insane. And yet this film does it with such freshness that I think it manages to, in its completely silly way, say a lot of valuable things about the insanity with which we go off to kill each other. And I think that's, kind of a great thing that he did that so beautifully that it doesn't never feel like it's a film with a message or anything like that. But there's some of the best anti-war stuff on film might be in this completely silly movie.
The one connection I see to that with that war scene, as you're talking about sort of absurdity of war, would have been obviously a big influence on Woody would be the Marx Brothers and sort of Duck Soup and how they handle that whole thing in there as well.
Yes, absolutely. And that flashed in my head too, that Duck Soup was another film that is an utterly silly movie, but that actually has some ideas underneath it that aren't just silly.
So you are Don Francisco?
Yes, I have regards from your brother in Spain. Says you went away, you don't write, nothing, comes a Friday night, he never hears from you. You took his razor, you never returned it.
This is an honor for me.
No, it's a greater honor for me.
No, a greater honor for me.
No, it's a greater honor for me.
No, a greater honor for me.
Well, perhaps you're right. Perhaps it is a greater honor for you.
And you must be Don Francisco's sister.
No, 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 it's a greater honor for me.
I see our Spanish guests have a sense of humor.
Yeah, she's a great kidder.
No, you're a great kidder.
No, you're Don Francisco's sister.
Shall we dine?
Oh, can we eat first?
Another thing that stands out for me with this is how great some of the little supporting performances are in this movie. And that's happened to some of the earlier Woody films. But to me, again, this kind of went up another step. And I mean, I think James Tolkien's Napoleon and Harold Gould, in some of these smaller parts, Jessica Harper, are really, really great. And people are playing more than I think in the earlier Woody movies. People aren't playing just for the comedy. I mean, they're incredibly funny, but they're managing to ground it in something that feels like it doesn't feel like you're watching a sketch. You're not watching a Saturday Night Live piece. Suddenly you're watching characters who are hysterically funny, but are grounded a little bit more as human beings. And that is a different tone, I think, than even Sleeper and certainly Take the Money and Run and some of the earlier films.
Well, I think it was very adventurous for him, too, to set this, in the early 1800s in Russia, first time that he's done that. I mean, of course, the previous film, Sleeper, set a couple hundred years in the future, but it almost all takes place out in the woods. There's a couple of futuristic houses, but otherwise it's, kind of location neutral.
Yes.
And this one, he kind of really goes out of his way and makes it really kind of brings it to us. And then that makes some of these weird, anachronisms even funnier. Him being a cheerleader or the black drill sergeant or, even one of my favorite lines is about,
you think I was made in God's image? Take a look at me. You think he wears glasses?
Not with those frames.
Well, and there's actually a lot of things that were breakthroughs in this, and even things that he hasn't done again that were kind of brilliant. I mean, the using the Prokofiev music and using classical music. I mean, everybody always thinks of Woody in terms of jazz, and this was a case where it's a purely classical score, and he may have done it again, although it's not popping into my head. If so, when? But this is unlike any score in any other Woody Allen film, and that was, I thought, a very adventurous and really successful. I mean, that score was fabulous and really helped set the tone of the film and was something, he hasn't really done before or since.
You talked a little bit about the jokes kind of getting funnier as we get older and we kind of understand more and has see more. I never really got the whole joke with his father coming to visit him in jail and their whole conversation being Dostoevsky titles until just recently when I watched The Time Before Last, and it's like, okay, now I finally get why this is funny.
Oh yeah. No, I don't think I got that till way later. And actually, to be honest, a lot of the Bergman references, until I saw Bergman in my 20s and 30s, I didn't get what they were. There's a lot of references, both in terms of Russia and in terms of other films, and in terms of, you know, that you have to kind of be exposed to a lot of stuff to be able to be hip to, which is what part of why it's fun to go back to this movie, because there's always something new that you didn't catch. It's also just so dense. I mean, the dialogue comes so fast and so funny, and it's so smart that there's just stuff that you miss because there's so much of it. And so I feel like there's more to dig through in this movie, you know, than there were in the earlier comedies, which, yeah, I mean, again, I think Bananas is hysterically funny. I mean, I love those movies, but to me, this one takes another step up in terms of just how much is going on. The visual comedy, the verbal comedy, the depth of the writing, how good all the acting is. I mean, it's sort of everything coming together and firing on all cylinders.
And he did it earlier, and I know you were talking about, you know, the Dostoevsky references and all this other stuff, but also I think at the time when I saw it too, the first time, I didn't get all the philosophical talk and the references to, you know, oh, have you seen this kind of Jew and that kind of Jew? Well, that one has horns and this one has tails, and the absurdity of anti-Semitism in Russia and all of this stuff. So as you're saying, I mean, it does, if you have this background, it just totally opens up new levels in terms of what you can really appreciate in the film.
I love the repartee in this film. I love the way that every line is always followed by a joke, and just that kind of rhythm that they have. And what this really kind of proves to me too is just what a brilliant comedian Diane Keaton was, because half the jokes are hers and half the jokes are Woody's. I mean, she is just as there with her timing and delivery as Woody Allen was with his. I mean, the scene where she's kind of wooing and being wooed by the guy who's, she's playing violin, he's playing piano, and then of course they switch.
Your skin, it is so beautiful.
Yes, I know. It covers my whole body.
She really just is so brilliant in this film.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to me, this was a big leap forward for her, too, as a performer. I mean, I thought she was certainly good in Sleeper, but I think in this film, she really completely is on equal footing with Woody in terms of making the comedy work and being a true team with him. I think in Sleeper, it still felt like he was the driving force, and she was kind of wonderful and had a great sort of endearing presence. But I think in this film, her timing and her ability as an actress is really starting to come to the fore. And she's great. I mean, she makes moments work just as much as he does. I mean, whether it's the repartee or even the more the silent comedy moments with the hitting each other over the head with the bottle, and you know, that stuff is really hard to do, and she did it just brilliantly. It's a really smart movie. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it is a truly smart movie, and it's a movie that asks that the audience be smart to get it, and I think that's great.
One of the things I was thinking about too, Mike, and you were talking about sort of how this is staged in Russia during that period, is for another reason I was flashing back onto another director who was doing a comedy within sort of, I guess maybe that even that same time period, it may have been a little later, is when Mel Brooks did The 12 Chairs, and just sort of looking at American Jewish filmmakers somehow going back at this time in the 70s and trying to pull stuff out of Eastern Europe or Russia or sort of the background that they may have come from in the home country in some way. Do you see any sort of connection with that?
I wonder if it was the Fiddler on the Roof phenomenon, because this would have been right around that time when Fiddler on the Roof was probably on Broadway and hot. Seems like a good time to kind of go back and visit Mother Russia. I don't know. That's just the immediate thing that came to my head. And it's funny that you bring up The 12 Chairs, because that one is really kind of an unsung film for me when it comes to Mel Brooks. I love that movie, and hardly anybody seems to reference it.
I love 12 Chairs, too. I mean, in some ways, it's, I think, one of Brooks' best films. It's a little bit more subtle and understated, but it has become a bit of a forgotten movie. I don't quite know why. I mean, maybe just it is more subtle, but I love that film, and it is interesting because it has those similarities of going back to Russia and being period and having a level of sophistication that Brooks's other films hadn't.
The other thing in here that I noticed, and seems to be an obsession with hair. One guy goes off to war, he's got a lock of hair, there's like a gift of a mustache, there's the rabbi with the giant beard that Diane Keaton steps on. I was trying to figure out this like obsession with hair.
You know, it's really funny because you're absolutely right. I mean, there's about a good 7 or 8 hair jokes in the movie. I wonder if it's when Woody's hair was starting to really thin or something, and so it was on his mind. I don't know. It's a good observation, but boy, God knows where that would have come from.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about how dense the dialogue and stuff was, and it was great. I had a chance to read one of the early drafts of the script. I think I sent that over to you, Keith.
Yeah.
Where they not only would they have the jokes, would Woody Allen have the jokes, but then he would have alternates in there too, like, which one am I going to use? And he would just have all these different comebacks to different lines, and he'd have things in parentheses like, you know, alternate take is this, which I thought was great.
Oh, it was fabulous. And it was interesting to see, you know, about 60 or 70% of the time he'd use the original, but then about 30% of the time he'd use the alternate. I imagine, although I don't know, that that probably means they shot both, and then he was able to choose later on what would work. The thing that struck me too reading the script was how close to the script they stayed. I mean, you know, for a film that, you know, has got a sort of crazy spirit to it, a Marx Brothers feeling to it, you know, there wasn't much that was improvised. There were certainly a few bits that are in the final film that aren't in the script, but generally he stayed very, very close to it. And most of that stuff was really thought out ahead of time, which I think is very impressive, because the film has a feeling of spontaneity to it. And yet clearly it was really thought through very, very, very carefully.
It was neat, too, that some of the visual jokes weren't even listed in there, like the whole thing with the lions that, you know, the kind of nod to Battleship Potemkin. Like, I don't remember that being in the script. I don't remember the persona joke at the end with them talking about wheat, that thing happening in there. And then some of the stuff, I love the scene, speaking of physical, and this one, all the lines were there, but the way that it was acted out really just brings so much more to it. That whole scene where Diane Keaton is thinking to herself, and we've got her on the left side of the screen and Woody Allen on the right side of the screen, and he just keeps talking about wheat.
The crops, the grains, fields of rippling wheat. Wheat, all there is in life is wheat.
Sonia, here's your chance to do something kind for a dying boy. But I don't really love Boris. I mean, I love him, but I'm not in love with him.
Oh, wheat, lots of wheat, fields of wheat, a tremendous amount of wheat.
And yet he loves me, and he would make a devoted husband. Not too exciting, but devoted. We'd have a family, maybe not our own. We could rent one. I could learn to love him. Me, Boris, and 6 rented children. Or would I feel trapped, suffocated, can't breathe? Open a window. No, not that one. The one in the bathroom.
Yellow wheat, red wheat, wheat with feathers, cream of wheat.
Poor boy, dueling with Anton Lebedikov. By this time tomorrow morning, my beloved cousin Boris will look like a Swiss cheese. Promise him anything. Make him happy for a night. Oh, or would I feel trapped, suffocated, my youth gone, living with a Swiss cheese and rented children? Of course I'll marry you, Boris. It would be an honor for me.
And all those lines are there, but the way that it's film just makes it so much better, just to see both of those characters on screen at the same time, just having their weird inner dialogues.
That's where the film to me was a step forward for him, because it was, you know, it was all there in the script, but then in the way he shot things, you know, they took another step up. I mean, they weren't just the funny lines, but then they were framed and shot in ways that really pushed them to a whole other level. And I think that's a great example of that. I mean, or the references to you know, Battleship Potemkin, where the only thing in the script that I saw of it was at the end of the script, there's just a little like note just said to something like Potemkin. You know, there's like, but it just like doesn't say like what he's going to do with it. It's like somewhere he knew he was going to do something with it.
I mean, they were so subtle. It wasn't like he was doing the whole Odessa step sequence with the baby cart and all this kind of stuff, you know, that we would see later on and like, you know, the Untouchables and other things. But just those, like, I mean, a quick shot of somebody with their glasses being broken and blood coming out of their eyes. I mean, just blink and you miss it kind of thing. But it's like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, I've seen that shot 100 times before. It's so nice.
Yeah. If you don't know the reference, it still works fine. It's not only working as a joke. It's working as actually a piece of storytelling. But if you know what it's coming from, it's just all the better.
You know, comparing the script of Love and Death to what we finally saw, I mean, there are just little surgical removals of lines just to tighten up scenes and everything. And I agree with you that they were probably all shot, but he probably just kept tweaking and tweaking and tweaking until he got exactly what he wanted, because those scenes, I mean, they're, everything is tight as a drum in this film. And I think some of those I could see, okay, maybe this scene would have gone on for a little too long, but I mean, just a couple, like a line here, you know, a quick scene here, that kind of stuff. It's just, he was very meticulous, it seems, with exactly what he was going to do with this film and what he gave us.
There's nothing he took out that I read in the script and went, how could you possibly lose that? I mean, they were great things. I mean, I love the thing where the specter of death was being held up by a thread, and you could see the thread And he basically is saying, well, you know, even God doesn't get everything right. And, you know, it was just a great idea, but I could see it being kind of too much of an aside as the movie was kind of rushing to a climax. It seems very intentional and well done in terms of the carving, but, you know, as someone you love something, I would love to see more of it. I just love to have a version that had all those things in it, even though I think he probably made nothing but right decisions about what stayed and what didn't in the final film.
There's a DVD version of the Blues Brothers out there where they kind of went back and re-edited some of the scenes. And not only am I just used to how the original Blues Brothers plays, but it feels like all the jokes in this new version kind of last one beat too long. It needed to be cut right there, but they go on for just a little bit more. And there's none of that in Love and Death. It's just, okay, here it is, bam, gone, on to the next scene.
Everything, you know, it's a very, very beautifully efficient storytelling machine. Most of those extended cuts to me are you actually look at them and go, actually, there was a reason you cut it the way you did the first time. There are rare exceptions. I mean, certainly, I think the longer cut of Almost Famous, the Cameron Crowe movie, the director's cut of that, I think is a huge improvement. That extra half hour makes a big difference in that movie. But a lot of films, especially films that really are terrific films, great films like Love and Death, kind of were probably cut the way they were cut for good reason.
I think it's only 90 minutes. And it kind of, to me, fits into, I've seen John Waters talk about this, and he's like, no comedy should ever be over 90 minutes in his mind. He's like, because nobody's ever sat down and said, you want to hear a really long joke? It's just, you know. So it's, he goes, you know, the shorter it is, usually the better it is for a comedy. And it's obvious with that. And the thing that I like about that, even in terms of, I think him even understanding at some point, and I don't know if this is in the script, you guys looked at it, is there's one point where, you know, in breaking the fourth wall, which nobody does as good as Woody does, is he goes, all right, well, I'm all out of cliches now. And it just sort of like moves on towards the end.
There is that line where his mother is just all over him.
He'll go and he'll fight. And I hope they will put him in the front lines.
Thanks a lot, Mom. My mother, folks.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes and continue our discussion on Love and Death.
Do you suffer from excessively flabby jowl syndrome? Of course you do. Do your earlobes keep you up at night? Whose doesn't?
Wait. Stop this commercial right away. I'm taking it over.
Why, look, everybody, it's Kermit the...
No, don't say that. I'm not Kermit the Frog. Rhino testicles. I get that all the time. My name is Alan, and I'm actually more of a toad. Plus, we don't want to get sued. That's besides the point. I'm here to tell listeners they don't need whatever irrelevant pill or medical treatment you're about to sell them. All they need is the After Movie Diner podcast.
What are you talking about?
Every Monday, the AMD podcast brings you comedy, film discussion, and original music. There's also interviews with film directors, actors, and producers, and interesting guest hosts.
Wow, my whole life has been a sham. I'm worth less than nothing.
Oh, don't be silly, Mr. Voiceover Man. It's simple. First, grow a beard. Then, second, read this, and you too can be amazing.
Really? I always wanted to believe in magic.
Why are there...
Oh, no. We don't have time for a song. Certainly not one that's far too expensive. Just read your damn lines. Friggin' amateurs.
Well, we quite agree, Kurt. I mean, Alan. So we got this guy instead.
Go to amdpodcast.blogspot.com or search for After Movie Diner on iTunes, TalkShoe, Podbean, or Facebook, and get that dose of goodness that you've been looking for all your sleepless nights, long commutes, lonely weekends, maybe spent dressed in a tutu playing checkers with a machine eating Nutella straight from the jar. It's the After Movie Diner podcast, filled with all the B movie vitamins your body deserves.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
It was a childhood corrupted by endless hours of VHS rentals.
Well, sick, demented shit, you'd love it.
In his most formative years, he had seen it all.
I can handle anything.
Action.
Karate is not to be used aggressively. But if I have no other choice.
Horror. And romance. Now, he's decided it's time to go back. For just one more adventure.
Humans are such easy prey.
Noel Meller presents...
You're the problem, you little shit!
The Adventures in VHS Podcast.
Join me, Noel Meller, as each month I take an in-depth look at one movie from my collection of ex-rental 80s VHS classics and speak to one or two of the people involved with making them about what the format means to them.
The Adventures in VHS Podcast.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Download today from iTunes by searching for Adventures in VHS or visit adventuresinvhs.com.
Hello, this is Mike from the BadassesBoobsAndBodyCounts.com website and podcast. At the BB&BC website, I post thoughts, or reviews if you will, of lesser-known action, exploitation, and horror films. In the all-new BB&BC podcast, I talk about films of the same genre, but usually with a guest host. We discuss films such as...
And I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is back on the scene. I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is my name and...
Dolomite, which falls into the badass category. We also look at films like
I should have taken you for a stone cold dyke from the start.
Oh! You.
Pervert. In the boobs category. In the body counts category, we cover films like
What's going on here? What do you think you're doing?
We're having an orgy. What's it to you?
Enjoying the fun?
You all think you're so smart, don't you?
Well, you ain't. You ain't so damn smart after all. You just wait and see.
Somebody's always trying to spoil our fun.
So we have a devil of a good time.
The Satan's Cheerleaders. And last but not least, we also look at films such as
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
Manos, the Hands of Fate, in the Everything Else category. The BB&BC website is located at badassesboobsandbodycounts.com, and the BB&BC podcast can be downloaded from the iTunes Store, the BB&BC website, and is also now available on Stitcher Smart Radio. Just do a search on BB&BC podcast to start listening.
We're here to see the Emperor.
Who is calling?
Oh, that's Droll.
Droll, yes. Apparently he's not familiar with the list of the 100 most important Spanishers.
Yes, it is only Don Francisco and his sister.
Yes, the Danessa.
Yes, we have an appointment with Napoleon.
Christ, Napoleon Bonaparte, the noted international tyrant.
You are Don Francisco and his sister.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Well, we have had a hot journey.
A hot journey.
And our throats are parched.
Parched. Our throats are parched.
We seek succor. Succor.
Succor.
Yes, is succor here by any chance?
I never knew your name, madam.
Oh, the boys usually just call me Juanita.
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 Juanita. The Emperor is a man who appreciates a magnificent woman. He will be much taken with you.
Good. I wore my flats.
We are, of course, almost anxious to hear your proposal for a treaty.
Oh, great. I've given a lot of thought. Now, I've come up with all the little details, you know. Now, if I can just think of the main points, we got something.
Well, there's no time for business. You've had a wearing journey.
Yes, well, we should say hello to the Emperor.
That's right. Shorts gets touchy if we bypass him.
There'll be time for that later. First, you'll be shown your quarters and wined and dined in a manner befitting Spanish nobility.
Oh, wonderful, but go easy on the champagne. The Danessa has gout.
Well, if you'll proceed, your needs will be attended to. Glad you're here with your sister. Should you desire a little blonde French love dream to be sent to your room, it will be arranged.
Good, good. Maybe I'll have two to keep the symmetry perfect.
I prefer two myself.
I prefer three, but it's hard enough to get one.
All right, we're back, and we're talking about Woody Allen's Love and Death with Keith Gordon and my co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary. Love and Death, as we've said earlier in the discussion, it was made right after Sleeper and right before Annie Hall, which would just kind of, you know, take the world by storm, win all kinds of Oscars, yada, yada, yada. And we know that Woody had made just a ton of comedies before this. And afterwards, really, I mean, Annie Hall, yeah, there's some funny bits to it, quite a few, actually. But afterwards, for a little while, it seemed like we got kind of a different side of Woody, kind of got a more, I don't want to say dour, but definitely a much more serious feel to him. What do you guys think as far as the whole progression of Woody Allen's career? I mean, because after Annie Hall, I mean, we get that, like, what, Interiors, Manhattan, Stardust Memories kind of phase. What do you think about this stuff? Keith, I'll start with you because you seem to be the biggest Woody fan here.
Well, I mean, I love those films. I mean, one of the things that I think makes Woody such a remarkable filmmaker is the breadth of what he's done over his career. I mean, not only the sheer number of films he's made, but the number of tones that he's worked in, and the fact that he went from making really some of the greatest pure comedies of certainly the last 50 years, to making some incredibly moving films. I mean, Annie Hall, you know, winning Best Picture and being one of the definitive films on relationships. And it's still a comedy, but it's a comedy with a tremendous amount of heart. To Interiors, which, you know, is a very dark drama. And I think sort of which took a lot of unfair drubbing, I think. You know, perhaps it is imitative of, or not perhaps, it is imitative of Bergman, but it's also a terrific film in its own way, and a lot of filmmakers imitate other filmmakers, and if you're going to imitate somebody, Bergman's not the worst person to imitate. I mean, one of the things I love about Woody is watching through, you know, what is now a, you know, 50-year almost film career, the fact that he's never stopped changing and growing, and that he doesn't just have this thing that he does and do it over and over again. And I think he made some remarkable films in the next section of his career. I think Zelig is a remarkable film. You know, and the kind of technical wizardry that film has, which, you know, people were doing stuff 10 years later and getting all this sort of attention for doing that kind of work with visual effects. And because it was a Woody Allen comedy, people didn't stop and realize what a remarkable piece of filmmaking that was on a technical level. I think Stardust Memories is a wonderful and underrated film, you know, about fame and the absurdities of fame and trying to be an artist in a society and that doesn't really have a lot of room for it and how you yourself get corrupted by it. But all those movies, I mean, I think Crimes and Misdemeanors is an incredible combination of the earlier Woody in that it can be very funny and the later Woody in that it is a heart-crushing film about, you know, what is the nature of responsibility. And I think very few artists that we've gotten to experience, you know, whether it's in film or music or playwriting or whatever, have had the kind of growth that Woody had over the course of his career, at least for me. I mean, I just find that remarkable. And that even now, I mean, even in his later films, he's continuing to do some things differently. I mean, you know, maybe not at the pace that he did when he was younger, but he continues to seem to me like he never, you know, I still look at a film like whatever, Match Point or You'll Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, and they're kind of different. He continues to go, you know, what's something I haven't done? And within a format that's maybe generally familiar, he continues to seem to try to stretch himself. And to me, that's what was great. I mean, as great as those early films were, as great as Bananas and Take the Money and Run and Sleeper and even and Love and Death are, how much poorer we all would have been if that was it, if that was what he just kept doing for all the years since and not kind of moved on to all the other sorts of work that he did.
I have my answer. I have my answer. I'm walking on air.
I remember for myself having a discussion with a friend of mine I produced a film with. This is probably 15 years ago or so. And Sean said to me, he goes, you know, if I were to sit down and think of one American filmmaker who, like Shakespeare 400, 500 years from now, we would still be watching or caring about if films still last that long, he thought that it was Woody Allen. That Woody Allen represented, as I was talking about with this title, Love and Death, talking about a lot of fundamental things that hundreds of years from now, even though we might not understand the New York reference per se, we would still be able to understand the base reference of what he's getting at and what he's expressing to us about the most sort of human parts of ourselves.
I think it's a really good point. That's a very arguably true statement, because he, I mean, a film like Hannah and His Sisters, all those films, they have that, you know, what Shakespeare had, which is a deep understanding and affection for and sharp eye and sharp tongue to human nature. And that probably will be the same 100 or 200 or 500 years from now as it is now. So I think that that's something that his films have. And again, I think because he's so funny and because he's been all over the map and tried so many things, I think people don't appreciate how amazing what he's created is and the body of work is and how many great – I mean, it's amazing when you start going through the list of all his films. You go, oh, that's a great film, and that's a great film. There aren't a lot of filmmakers where you can point to, you know, 10, 12, 14, 15 films and say they're truly great films. I mean, there are not many have done that.
And I love these kind of left turns that he takes in his career. I mean, you know, you've got Hannah and Her Sisters – nestled between Radio Days and Purple Rose of Cairo. I can see going from Purple Rose to Radio Days, but having Hannah and Her Sisters right there in the middle, such a different film. Or to go from Shadows and Fog to Husbands and Wives to Manhattan Murder Mystery. Husbands and Wives is still one of these great films that just still makes me uncomfortable when I watch it today. It really just put me on edge when I watched it in a good way, you know, that kind of visceral reaction to it. And just that he was going, you know, he was such a, I wouldn't say a traditionalist, but, you know, he was very formal a lot in his filmmaking. And then he breaks left completely with that one and doing the whole handheld camera stuff. I remember people, you know, coming out of the theaters and saying, oh, geez, I feel ill after watching this. But it was great that he was adopting this kind of NYPD blue camera style, all handheld kind of stuff, making this film, which really was just so appropriate to the kind of, you know, emotional turmoil that these characters are going through. And then you wonder, too, you know, how much of this is reflecting what's going on in his own life as well. I mean, of course, again, we always are trying to figure that kind of stuff out. But to think that maybe even if there was just a little glimpse of what was going on with his home life in this, it makes that movie even more powerful to me. And yeah, just such amazing turns. I mean, to go from, you know, we talked Annie Hall to Interiors, I can see why he kind of got, you know, the throbbing on that, just because it was such a different film.
People were ready for that, and very few artists do it. I mean, very few people make those kind of completely bold changes of style. You know, usually what you see is subtle little pieces of growth or change, but Woody really, especially in the first half of his career, but I continue to think in the second half, you know, really challenged himself and was willing to risk failure and was willing to risk rejection in a rather remarkable way. And that's part of what makes his film so exciting, is that he, you know, and I think your point about Husbands and Wives and the way it was shot is a great one. And if you look at his films, they continue to, how he shoots his films continues to evolve from film to film, cinematographer to cinematographer, subject matter to subject matter. And it's kind of a wonderful thing. While it's not one of my very favorite of his films on a kind of an emotional level, Match Point is, you know, a really incredibly different film on a cinema level than any of his other movies. And he was already, you know, I don't know what, well into his late 60s or whatever when he made that movie, and made a film that really kind of didn't look, sound, or feel like anything else he'd ever done. That's hard for anybody to do. I mean, in any artistic field, to keep reinventing yourself. And it's funny, because I don't think he's gotten quite the credit for that he deserves. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it's because his persona hasn't changed that much. It's the one thing that's remained much more the same. But I don't think people really have recognized enough how wide-ranging his art has been.
I would say even Love and Death doesn't really get the respect it deserves. I mean, people look at the early comedies, they look at the middle part and some of these older films or more recent films, but it seems that it treads that line between Annie Hall and Sleeper so much that people really don't know what to make of it a lot of times. You know, I picked up quite a few books on Allen while I was doing research for this episode, and it feels like, okay, yeah, we'll talk about Take the Money and Run and Bananas. Maybe we'll talk about Sleeper a little bit, and then we'll jump to Annie Hall and we'll talk about Interiors. And it's like, hey guys, there's a really important film right here in the middle. Do you just not know how to handle it, or is it just not, you know, deemed important enough, or what is it? Is it that it's too comic to be considered serious, or is it not funny enough? Or, you know, obviously to the three of us, we think it's pretty hilarious, but it was weird that it was just this kind of blank spot on his resume a lot of times.
Well, I was saying before, to me, I don't know that he could have made the leap to Annie Hall without making this leap first, because I think this was a leap to being a master filmmaker in terms of mastering the medium, and that's what let him then, in Annie Hall, take that next step. So I think on that level alone, on top of being a brilliant film, it's also an incredibly important film in his body of work. And also, the thing I mentioned to you guys before we started that I'd read, and I wish I could remember where it was, but was it supposedly, I read somewhere recently that of all the films that he loves Love and Death the most, that's one that's kind of his personal favorite, which I found interesting and surprising, but in a way not, because it was the film where I think he grew up from being a really funny guy who made movies into being a great filmmaker. And I think part of the reason people don't know what to do with it is it is the middle of that change that he made from being a guy who made these funny movies to a guy who made all-time great films.
The one thing that it seems is that in the later years now, instead of playing certain roles himself, there's actors who seem to be playing a character version of Woody Allen. And I just sort of want your take on that. If Woody ever came to you and said, hey, I want you to in this part, how would you handle that?
For my taste, the people who've done it best, and again, I think this is about Woody and what he's asked of people and who he's cast, are the people who did seem to be imitating him the least. I mean, at least for me, because there's always going to be a certain rhythm to his writing. But for example, I thought that, you know, Owen Wilson didn't really just do a Woody imitation. I mean, he had Woody's rhythm because the writing has it, but he kind of also kept his own persona alive. And to me, that worked better than some of the other people that I feel like I'm watching do a second-rate Woody Allen imitation, and I think that's something that works better when he's had actors who are like, okay, I will play the you part, but I'm going to play it still from who I am, and it's been interesting to watch different people do that. It's when I also think, you know, in some of the films it's been interesting is when he's not had people do that, and when he's sort of abandoned, you know, that's why a film like Match Point is so interesting, because there is, that I can think of, no Woody Allen surrogate in that movie. And I wonder if, as he continues to make films, you know, if that will be the case. If he'll say, you know, or as in To Rome with Love, he's in the film, but in a supporting role, and that's the Woody role. But you don't feel anybody else doing a Woody Allen shtick. And I like that best. I always feel a little uncomfortable when I feel like I'm watching an actor, even a very good actor, sort of do a Woody Allen imitation.
So repeat after me, Keith. These pretzels are making me thirsty.
Well, you know, it's that. The terrible thing is I can't do a Woody Allen imitation at all, but which I guess disqualifies me from being a New York Jewish actor. I'm betraying my heritage. But yeah, I think Woody was a unique presence on screen. I think trying to, you know, do a Beatlemania version is never a great idea of somebody like that.
I do a horrible Woody Allen, and it drives my wife absolutely crazy. So, which is always fun to do. So I'll just kind of do that whole hemming and hawing thing that he does, you know, that kind of second-guessing himself as he keeps adding little bits and everything, and that just drives me up a wall. So that's always fun.
What's funny is, and I haven't really thought this through, so I could be saying something incredibly stupid, but another unsung thing he may have done with films was create room for a certain kind of neurotic male leading man. You know, not just people doing Woody Allen imitations, but I wonder how many other kind of neurotic, crazy characters that grew out of the years after Woody became a major figure in film, he sort of opened the door for. You know, leading men in movies were always very sort of waspy, handsome, you know, a certain kind of guy was the guy who would be the lead in your movie. And I wonder if some of the more quirky characters that we've had in the years since that are nothing like Woody, but if some of that freedom was bought by somebody like Woody becoming a star, despite being in absolutely no way, shape, or form the sort of the American ideal of what a movie star should be.
I had read a review once that said if it wasn't for Woody Allen and specifically Annie Hall, you probably wouldn't have had Seinfeld be such a big thing as it was.
Yes, I'm almost sure that's true. I bet you could come up with a list of 15 of those, but I think that one is a great example. But there was a certain permission that he gave to be, you know, to be male and get the girl, but still be neurotic and messed up and nervous and flustered and a mess. And yet he still ended up with the girl a lot. You know, he still had all these beautiful women in the films. And I think that that was sort of a really interesting liberation of what our image of men in movies was. And I don't think he was the only part of that. I mean, I think you had the Dustin Hoffmans and people like that coming out of this, you know, 60s as leading men when that was not very at all the sort of image of leading men before. But Woody was really appearing about that same time. It was really the late 60s, early 70s that you had people like Hoffman or Pacino or whatever kind of starting to make us look at leading men differently. And Woody was very much a part of that, I think, that movement.
We're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
That was horrible.
That'll drive the Mrs. crazy.
Sounded like one of the Jerky Boys.
There you go.
With all the piss clams.
All right.
I think we should have just done this entire thing all doing really bad Woody Allen imitations.
So, Love and Death, it's a film. Obviously.
In every age, there is a cause worth fighting for. But in the future, the greatest threat to our survival will not be man at all.
Hey, kid, what's going on?
It's war! We're going to war!
Now the youth of tomorrow must travel across the stars to defend our world.
We are a generation commanded by fate to defend humankind.
Everyone fights, no one quits.
We are going in with the first wave. You smash the entire area. You kill anything that has more than two legs. You get me?
We get you, sir!
But they will face an enemy more devastating than any ever imagined.
Here it comes! Bob! Incoming!
Mayday, mayday, this is Roughneck Choosy Order.
We're under attack, so we need retrieval now.
Someone made a damn mistake.
The bugs laid a trap for us, didn't they? Ah!
Prepare for battle and journey to the front lines of the next frontier.
Kill them all!
Starship Troopers.
Okay, so after that horrible imitation, that's right, we're going to be discussing Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers next week. So I want to thank this week's special guest host, Keith Gordon. Keith, I understand, about to start some new work, episodes of Dexter, and what else you got going on?
Yeah, I'm about to start doing the first episode of the last season of Dexter, which is going to be fun because I've been sort of working on the show on and off since it started. So I'm glad to be part of the, you know, the last year of it. And I've been working with Christopher Nolan on a project for like 4 years now, and it is slowly, you know, moving along as things do in the Hollywood feature system. Just, you know, getting ready to turn in my second draft to the studio, and that would be something I would be directing as well as writing, and he would be exec producing. Can't talk much about it because he's somebody who is a great believer, I think with good reason, in secrecy, but it's been very exciting to get to work with somebody like that who I admire a great deal. And then I just did, I was a co-exec producer and directed the pilot for a new series that the Sundance Channel is doing. It was actually their first scripted series that they produced called Rectify, which is a really interesting piece created by this guy, Ray McKinnon, who's a wonderful actor, but also won an Academy Award for his short film that he made. And it's really, as TV usually is, it's the creator and showrunner whose baby is really the show, and it's Ray's show. But I was very glad to be a part of it. It's a piece about a man who's let out of death row after 20 years. Although he's not exonerated, there's just some evidence, his DNA evidence comes to light that means he may be not guilty. So here's a man who was locked away at age 18 in a solitary confinement cell, and after 20 years is being released back into the world. And it's really about this first season, which is 6 episodes, is about his rebirth and coming back out into this small town in Georgia where he was living 20 years earlier, and where most people still think he's guilty of killing his girlfriend, and most people would like to see him dead, and both what it does to his family and to himself. sort of having to go through a rebirth in this town, and also the drama and the tension of, is he going to face trial again, and what exactly did happen 20 years earlier, and is something bad going to happen to him now that he's out? And it's just a really beautifully written piece. I mean, Ray just wrote this incredible story, and I hope it will work for people. I thought it was something very kind of moving and quiet and sort of thought-provoking in a very kind of gentle way. Although it doesn't always have gentle moments, there's some very dark and disturbing moments in it as well. And I think that'll start airing in April, although I don't know that they have the date locked yet. So I've been doing, lots of different things, and feeling very lucky and grateful to be making a living doing what I want to be doing.
If you don't mind, I mean, I know you said you can't really talk about the specifics on the Christopher Nolan project that you're working with him on. How did you two originally hook up?
Well, here's the honest answer is I'm not entirely sure of what the whole genesis of it was. I sort of got summoned. We were on the film festival circuit at around the same time. I mean, when Memento was catching on and Following was out there, was when I had films out, Mother Night and films, around the same time. So I think we crossed paths at some festivals, but really it was kind of a left field thing where I was sent this book that they had, which will go nameless because I'm not allowed to name it, not a particularly well-known piece. And they said they were looking for somebody to write and direct it, and then they thought I might be right. And it was not a piece of material that I thought I was obvious for at all. It was sort of a thriller with some supernatural overtones to it. But I thought it was a really interesting piece with a lot of kind of neat, just an unusual amount of depth for that sort of subject matter. And I went in and I sort of pitched what I liked about the original material, what I didn't, what I thought needed to be changed. And he was like, I agree with almost everything you're saying, and let's work on it. And then we spent a lot of time. I mean, Chris is this amazing perfectionist. So we spent 2 years just working on the treatment of the piece before we even brought it into Warner Brothers, which is his home studio. So there were like about 11 drafts that we did, of just this treatment while he was prepping the Batman movie and while he was, so in between, I would sort of be doing versions and getting his feedback and working with Jordan Goldberg, who runs his company, and kind of developing the story. And then we went and took it into Warner Brothers, and then we spent the last 2 years since then, writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I mean, I've done about 27 drafts of the piece at this point, although we are only now officially putting in our second official draft. But that's part of how he works. I mean, he's a tremendous perfectionist, and they're always open to reexamining stuff. He really enjoys, like, okay, yes, we've done this, but what happens if we do this? And so it pushes you and challenges you as a writer to go places you wouldn't ordinarily go. And hopefully it means that the script is, that much better for it. And hopefully it means it'll actually get made.
Any idea on your hope on if it goes through the process, when you might be able to start working on it?
Well, at this point, I'm not too focused on that, other than it's set in New York City in the winter. So I'd like to be shooting it in New York City in the winter. But, if the studio came to us and said, yes, we want to make it, but, we need to make it, shooting in the fall, you make adjustments. Either you go somewhere else that will give you the weather that you need, or you do rewrites on the script. But in a perfect world, it would be sort of this time next year that we'd be shooting. That would be, if somebody just said to me, well, you can do this any way you want, because that was just, to me, I grew up in New York, and New York in the winter has a very certain kind of feeling to it that I just feel is right emotionally for this piece. So that would be, all else being equal, what I'd like to see happen. But, I'll be very happy if somebody actually says, we want to make it, but sorry, you have to shoot it X place. I can make that work. It's not a location dependent film in that sense.
Well, Keith, you have to set it at Christmas time.
I do seem to end up with Christmas in a certain number of my movies. Although Christmas is not particularly a theme in this as much as winter, I have been back at Christmas a couple of times.
Well, we just did a great Christmas movie. We just talked about Eyes Wide Shut a few weeks ago. So yeah, at least you can reuse some of the Masonic symbolism that Kubrick was using in there. I didn't know that you had the history with this movie that you did. That is, when you started busting out that story about how you saw it before it premiered, I was like, oh, he's just pulling my leg. And then it's like, oh, shit, no, he's not.
No, I actually did. I got to see all the films, not really. I mean, I didn't see early edits of them because Woody was private enough about them that it wasn't like he was screening them and getting feedback particularly. But I did get to see them before the world did, which is really cool. Yeah, and I got to even be, you know, on the side. I mean, I was an extra in Sleeper, and I was, my dad was in Sleeper and in Take the Money and Run. And so, you know, I was definitely around that world a lot. And it was very cool because it was somebody that I really, you know, grew up feeling, wow, you really deserve my, you know, it was one thing to have hero worship for somebody when you're a kid, but to go up and go, no, you deserved it. You know, it's a good feeling.
Yeah, to be able to look back at those films all those years later and be like, no, those were really good.
Yeah, it wasn't just, I was, you know, a kid and thought, oh, wow, you're big and famous. And, you know, it was like, no, you really were as great as you seem. In Take the Money and Run, my dad is the guy who actually arrests Woody at the end. The cop was like, you know, where they were reminiscing about old times, and he's holding up the guy, and he goes, oh, wait, I just remember I'm a cop.
Wallet. I didn't hear you. Well, look, it's been great speaking to you, really.
Oh, it's so nice to see you, Virgil.
Yeah, you too. Take it easy. Yeah. Never see you again.
Yeah, best of luck to
you. Okay.
Virgil. I just realized.
Yeah.
I'm a cop.
No kidding. How's it going?
Oh, it's a great job.
Yeah.
I get a pension.
Yes. Do you remember when we went up to the building?
That's actually my dad. So you know, the history goes all the way back to that.
Where were you in Sleeper?
Oh, I'm out of focus in the background. It's when they're showing him around, when they're first kind of reintroducing him to the world. And there's a shot where the woman's taking him around and says, and you're going to live here. And there's a super futuristic apartment building. Well, out of focus in the background, there's some kids running around and playing. And I'm one of those kids, as are Charlie Coffey's two daughters, who I've stayed close to my whole life since. And actually one of those daughters is Nicole Hollicenter, who's a wonderful, wonderful director in her own right. And then a woman that I lived with for years was Woody's assistant. So I have many, many connections to him. Gloria Norris who was assistant during Stardust Memories and Zelig. And so there's a lot of overlap. And then Bob Whitey, who's, you know, one of my oldest and best friends, just did the PBS two-part documentary on Woody. And, you know, got as close to him and as much information on how he worked as I think anybody's been able to do. So there seems to be this weird overlap that keeps happening, considering that I've met Woody all of maybe three times in my life and exchanged all of maybe 10 words. I don't have any really personal one-on-one relationship with him, but there's a lot of other people overlapping in my life. So he means a lot to me as a creative person, but also because our lives have a lot of these threads that kind of interact.
What do you think that from seeing all the films and obviously being a fan, like what does it do for you as a creative person and in your work? Where do you see his influence in what you do?
I think one of the things that for me is just the pure inspiration of the fact that he was so brave in doing stuff that, you know, might or might not work. I mean, the fact that he was constantly, you know, doing things and you'd kind of go, wow, can you do that? And he would just do it. You know, I look at my films and there's a lot of times that I'll do a shot that's kind of weird or somebody will look right in the camera or I'll do, you know, and the fact that he just always had that spirit was something that I found very inspiring. There's also projects of mine that have never gotten made that were much more Woody Allen-esque in their nature, you know, and just as the weird vicissitudes of the business are, I've gotten to make more in terms of my own films back when I was able to get money to make films. I ended up doing much more of the kind of dark dramas, but there were certainly a couple of comedies that I was working on that were much more directly influenced by Woody's kind of way of telling stories. So, you know, that's just, you know, people think of you a certain way and a lot of it has to do with, well, this is what happened to get done, but not necessarily what my only interests are. But, you know, I think for me with him, you know, I mean, Kubrick was much more somebody where I can go, oh, here's a shot that I actually, you know, specifically took from him or something, or Scorsese. With Woody, it was just more this idea that, well, just because you haven't done this doesn't mean you can't. And that, I think, is a really important piece of inspiration, even if it's not specific in a kind of literal way.
All right. Well, thanks, Keith, for being on the show. I hope you had fun. I know I definitely did.
Blast.
Good.
No, I was. Thank you for asking me. You know, I love movies. I particularly love this movie. You guys are really smart, and it's fun to talk about movies with smart people and talk about movies that you love. So I was very glad to do it.
Well, cool. Yeah, we still got you on the list for a couple more, so I'll be bugging you. Hopefully, between Dexter and the Nolan project, maybe we can fit you in again later on in the year.
Well, the good thing about life in this business is you're alternately ridiculously disgustingly busy and then sitting on your butt doing nothing, you know, so if you catch me in one of those periods between the things, I will be so happy to do this. You know, I will jump at the chance.
Awesome. So I want to thank everybody for listening. Be sure to stop by the website projection-booth.com for more fun stuff. And don't forget our deadline for calling in and leaving us your thoughts on Reservoir Dogs. The deadline is nearly up.
That's right, the big 101 episode, and we want you to be a part of it. Give us a call, 734-666-0800. Leave your thoughts on the film, Quentin Tarantino, the projection booth in general, Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, whatever you want to talk about. And that number again, 734-666-0800. And Mike, once again, what?
It's free when you call from work.
I hope you had a good time.
I did. I had a good time. Oh, what's this sore on my lip? I better see the doctor. Doc, I have this sore on my lip.
You have a social disease, my friend.
Oh, my God.
If you do not treat it, you will go blind. Or insane.
Well, men, that is the end of the play.